grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 161, is an interview with Mara Starling. Mara has been absolutely blowing up in a world that maybe some of you listeners, a lot of you listeners, especially given the demographics of this particular audience, might not be terribly familiar with, but it's TikTok. Mara Starling is a trans Welsh witch who has been absolutely killing it over on TikTok, and she is sort of venturing out into other realms of social media as well. But her videos are delving into the realms of folklore and fairy tale and helping to disambiguate the differences between what it means to be Welsh versus what it means to be Celtic, and some of the terminology that's used and the language. And it's just so incredibly much fun. And one of the things that I was really excited to talk to Mara about is something that is obviously a recurring theme here on Inciting a Riot, given who I am, is that queer identity inside of the pagan community. It's something that has been, a passion of mine to discuss since before the show started. One of the reasons that people found me way back in the day were articles that I wrote for Witchvox, which is sort of a now defunct website where people used to submit articles and sort of a peer review online journal thing that eventually became not a peer review thing. one of the things that people asked me to write about, and one of the things that has sort of been a recurring theme of folks online, is that so much of modern paganism, at least how it exists here in the United States, is fertility based, is based around a gender binary of god and goddess, and whether it's Wicca or Wicca light or Wicca influenced, I mean, nobody can deny the fact that modern paganism here in the U.S. is skews very heavily Wicca, because it's the biggest pagan religion that there is here in the U.S. and abroad, and it's difficult to sort of parse out what paganism is without Wicca, but that's a whole different discussion. But suffice to say that quite a lot of modern pagan thought does sort of center around fertility and the gender binary and the goddess and the god and the ways that we interact with that very sexualized version of deity, sexualized version of religion, generally speaking, because each of the holidays also has a component to it about what the goddess and god are up to in the bedroom, what they're doing, how pregnant the goddess is, or exactly how horny the god is, etc., etc. Please save your hate mail. But because of that, there are a number of pagan identities, pagan people who identify outside of the gender binary, who identify outside of the typical heteronormative spectrum of I am a cis boy and you are a cis girl, and we are going to copulate using our genitals to make more cis boys and cis girls. And for a lot of queer folks and folks who are perhaps asexual, or perhaps have all sorts of different ways in which that particular spectrum, that particular heteronormative binary way of thinking doesn't fit with the way that we live in our bodies and experience the world, modern paganism can be a little bit of a tricky thing to navigate, especially in spaces where you do want to participate in some of those religions and some of those groups and some of those traditions that are very, very heavily fertility based and based around the concept of divine intercourse. So Mara, one of the things that she and I discuss, and one of the things that she discusses using her platform, especially on Twitter, is her difficulty as a trans woman, and as somebody who has been pagan. Gosh, she identified as pagan much younger than I did. and as somebody who has sort of grown up with both of those things, you know, she was able to start seeking out other like-minded pagan folks from childhood, really from her early preteen to teen years. And she both came to the knowledge of who she was as a trans person at the same time that she was seeking a home inside of the pagan community. So to hear her story of those two intersections of identity, for me, it was an incredibly powerful experience. And I'm really glad to have this conversation now, because here in the United States, and for those of you that are not in the United States, congratulations. I'm sure you're all patting yourselves on the back. You do that quite a bit on Twitter, like, oh, you stupid Americans. But, you know, here in the U.S., we just got through a really fraught election cycle. And we have a new president. And it is really easy for some folks to think that a new president fixes everything, or that a new president will fix everything at the bare minimum, especially if that president seems to more or less align with your politics, your identity, etc. And I'm glad to have this discussion with Mara, because I want us to stop thinking that way. That's not helpful. That's not a helpful discussion to have, because it inspires complacency and it allows for more kinds of bigotry and zealot-like behavior to happen down the road, because we stop monitoring those things. We stop caring. We get complacent. And we just assume that the people in power are going to take care of it at the end of the day. And what we've witnessed here in the last 4 years is that we are one election, we are one uprising, we're one guy with a Twitter account away from not having the same kind of democracy and the same kind of freedoms that we held before. So all of that to say, I'm glad that we're having this discussion now, because there are already cases coming forward, and there have been a lot of cases in the last 4 years that challenge the freedoms, that seek to limit the liberties of queer, of LGBTQ plus United States citizens. While President Biden has lifted the ban on transgender people serving in the military, there are states that have cases that are now seeking additional ways to limit the rights and liberties of transgender people. There are still quite a lot of people in the U.S. who are trying to roll back the rights of queer adults to get married. And there are all sorts of different kinds of intersectionally oppressed ways in which queer people here in this country are still limited or still live in fear, just because of who they are and how they were born. So I'm really glad to have this discussion, because I hope that this show, if it does nothing else, I hope that this show continues to help you challenge your own way of thinking and keeps you uncomfortable. It keeps you in a state of discomfort so that you never settle, so that you're never complacent. I do want to mention, as a little bit of an aside, that Patreon supporters heard this show first. If you would like to hear more about this kind of conversation and you want to support independent pagan media like this show, you can do so for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/incitingprojects. I was going to say this at the end of the show, but I figure I'll go ahead and get it out of the way. This show has been going, as of this recording, or at least inciting a riot, this thing, this entity, this brand that I've created has been going now for 12 years. It began in January of 2009. So happy anniversary to me. But because of that, and because of the age that I was when I created this, and the kinds of content that I've put out, which is really newsy stuff and really sort of current event things and stuff like that, I am going to go ahead and start archiving some old shows. It's going to help me for a lot of reasons. One, it frees up space so that I'm not paying so dadgum much a month. And two, it's just some of those kinds of conversations that we used to have 8, 10, 12 years ago, they're not current anymore. Information has surpassed what we talked about then, what we thought then, and we're having different kinds of conversations now. And I think that it is the most beneficial thing for you all as the audience to have the, you know, conversations from you know, the last couple of years. So that being said, if you have any desire to have some of those old shows with the terrible audio and the rough scripting and stuff, I am going to start archiving things. I've been trying to figure out, you know, do I want to do stuff that's just over 10 years old? You know, because that really represents some of just the really rough audio. I will tell you that there were some slip-ups in my early days that sort of conflated my secret identity with my Firelight identity. So that is something that I would certainly like to protect and maybe take away from the broader internet, especially given some of the stuff that has popped up in my DMs. y'all are... Woo! Boy. Gosh. Anyways, so if you have any desire to have some of those old shows, go ahead and download them now because they aren't going to be there publicly. They will still exist on Patreon. So Patreon supporters will get access to all archived shows. So as I archive things publicly, they will go onto the Patreon server so that you guys can access them if you want, and we can have a conversation about old content sort of within the context of the growth of this show. I don't exactly know how long ago I'm going to do it. I definitely know it's going to be everything from before 10 years ago, because like I said, the show's been going 11 and a half years, I guess, now. And some of that old stuff is just, it's just bad audio. It's bad takes. It's a lot of garbage. So, yeah, so that's what we're doing. Anyways, that's going to be it. Enjoy the interview with Mara Starling, and I'll be with you again at the end of the show. Mara Starling, thank you so much for being here today on Inciting a Riot, the podcast. How are you all the way in Wales?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm so good. I am so incredibly pleased because I have to tell you, I am an old person that has just recently gotten on TikTok, and I have become very, very fast, quickly obsessed with you. Very, very obsessed with you, your videos, your content, and the kinds of information and educational, you know, quippy, funny joke things that you put out on the World Wide Web. Tell us a little bit about you, your advocacy, your path, and how it led you to TikTok.
Absolutely. Well, I am a Welsh witch. I describe myself as a Swinraig. I'm a first language Welsh speaker. And a lot of my practice comes from the legends, myths, folklore and such of my land. I kind of dedicate myself to the pantheon of deities that exist from my land, but I'm also a folk magic practitioner, more so than a pagan, really. I would consider myself a witch over being a pagan. And then in my native Welsh language, I call myself a Swinraig. And yeah, I've been practicing for approximately... I would say, what's the word? Officially, I've been practicing for around 12 years now. But yeah, and my practice kind of took a complete turn into a different direction when I discovered actual Welsh folk magic and Welsh Celtic paganism, as opposed to just the standard kind of neo-pagan Wicca things and such, because that's kind of where I started into the neo-pagan witchcraft side of things, and started looking into Wicca and considered joining a coven. But then when I found Welsh Celtic paganism and modern druidry and things like that, my path took a complete different direction. So I've been in witchcraft and into paganism such for pretty much my entire life, because I'm still as old as I look. I'm only 24, 25. I have to get it right. 24, I think. And I guess I'm only just starting to publicly come onto the scene. And I've been posting onto like Instagram and such. And then TikTok obviously came from lockdown and the pandemic and such. I think everyone kind of came on TikTok during the pandemic. That's kind of what got me started into it. I did make a few videos on there once upon a time, but I received a lot of kind of transphobic comments on my video. So I think I ended up on the wrong side of TikTok. And so I kind of deleted my account, then restarted it again recently. And I think I found that there's obviously a desire for people to learn more about my culture, my heritage, the Welsh Celtic paganism, Welsh witchcraft, Welsh folk magic. I didn't expect there to be such a strong desire for people to learn more about it. And it makes sense, because I think a lot of us in Wales, we grow up not knowing much about our own culture because we live so close to England. And so everything is so England oriented. I mean, even among the pagan community, there's so many people I meet who still think that I'm English just because I live in Britain. So I think a lot of people find empowerment from my videos to kind of learn, because I get a lot of comments saying things like, oh, I didn't even realize there was anything. I'm Welsh and I never knew there was myths in Wales. And so, yeah, my TikTok came from me wanting to reach a broader audience to kind of share that empowering knowledge that we can connect to our own cultural heritage and to our own pantheon of myths and legends and folklore and folk magic that exist within Wales. And yeah, I made like a joke video and that one took off. A joke video that was very informative, if I do say so myself. But that one kind of took off and now I'm reaching a wider audience and I'm not prepared.
You know, it's interesting for me to say for me to hear you say that you started off in sort of the neo-pagan Wicca washed area of study, especially because of where you live and the culture of paganism that surrounds you. Because I just recently spoke to the owner of Treadwells in London, Dr. Christina Oakley Harrington. And, you know, she told me that it was so interesting to see the sort of influx of Americanized paganism in recent years, because it's very much not traditional English witchcraft or the English way of being a pagan. And I wonder, you know, you said that you've been practicing for 12 years or so, but is this, do you agree? Do you find that this Americanized paganism is newer to England, or when you started, was that kind of all that there was? Because I know, and I suppose question part B, I do really resonate with your query of your conundrum of trying to find something other than Wicca to study. And even books that say that they are not teaching Wicca end up basically teaching Wicca. Which, there's nothing wrong with Wicca, fine, you go be Wiccan, but sometimes people want to try to study something else, and it's difficult to find that. So I'm just curious about your experience of trying to seek out information.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a generational thing. For me personally, when I first started, so my first book on witchcraft was, I can't remember the name of the author, but the book's called Spells for Teenage Witches. It's somewhere over there on my bookshelf.
I've not heard still of that one, I don't think.
Oh gosh, it's such a cute little thing. It's like a little tiny handbook, pocketbook, spellbook. And it's literally, I thought it was something to do with Harry Potter when I first found it, because I was probably 11 or 12 at the time. And I found it in a charity shop or a thrift store, I think you call them. I don't know if you have charity shops as well. But I found it in a dusty little charity shop. And my mum, because I grew up in a non-religious household, she had no qualms at all. She didn't care about me being into witchcraft or anything like that. My mum bought it for me. And then I kind of started studying witchcraft from there, because I quickly realized about three pages into the book, I was like, this is not Harry Potter. This is not fantasy. This is real. I've finally found real witchcraft. And 11-year-old me kind of was overjoyed by that. And when I reread, because I do every now and then, I get nostalgic and I go back and I'm like, oh, what did I start on? What did I remember doing a friendship spell or something similar that was in there, something to attract friends, because I was a very bullied and isolated child, especially growing up. I grew up in the middle of nowhere as well. So I was in a rural farming community and my school only had 26 students. So obviously
you beat
me being...
Oh, you very much beat me. My whole town had 585 people in it. And our... Oh, yeah, but you... It sounds like you beat me quite a bit.
Yeah, so
wait, like your class was 26 or your entire school
no. was... So primary school, which is when you're between the ages of 5, 6 until 11, 12. Primary school was 26 students in total. In the entire school. And then when I moved to high school, and because I live on an I lived on an island when I used to live up there in North Wales, and basically there's only two or three high schools on the entire island. And when I moved to high school, there was only about 1,000 students in total, but that was because they were coming from everywhere off the island to this one little school. That was a shock to me. But yeah, I found this book and it was just, it was full of these little kind of make friends spell and protect yourself from bullies spell. And I did all of them. And they were, if I look back at it now, I can see a lot of what we consider modern neo-pagan Wicca, mm-hmm. but very much the, and I hope I'm not saying this in any kind of offensive way, but very much the 19
my podcast
kind
is
of...
called Inciting a Riot. You can say whatever you want, however you want.
It was very much the kind of 90s Silver Ravenwolf style American, what I would say American Wicca. It was all very much like clear quartz this and amethyst that and rose petals and things like that to cast your circle and a lot of fairy talk, a lot, but fairies and probably the Tinkerbell style because it was very much like, I do remember actually there's a spell in there for a parking space or something, like finding a parking space and you call upon the parking fairy. And it's, yeah, it's what we would consider
goddess
very kind
of
new age-y.
Goddess of face, find me now a parking space. That's the, everybody knows that one. There's.
But I would, it was really interesting to me because my teacher at primary school, who I now consider a mentor of mine, was also a practicing witch. And when she kind of realized that I was into witchcraft, which she said she always knew I would be, like growing up when she was teaching me art, she knew that I would eventually come to paganism. Mm-hmm. But when she kind of, when I turned about 15 and she got to know the fact that I was interested in paganism and such, she introduced me to her witchcraft. And it was really interesting to me seeing that parallel of generations, because everyone in my generation who is into witchcraft, it was all very kind of threefold law this, cast the circle that, crystals this, dream catchers that, very kind of neo-pagan.
You had dream catchers.
Yeah, all sorts of things like, oh, dream catcher spell. And nowadays I cringe looking back. It's just like, I would never now. But it was, yeah, very kind of what I would now refer to as American, because all the authors were American that I was reading. But when I met her, re-met her as a teen, and she introduced me to her witchcraft, she was from another generation. So she was in her 50s, 60s. And her style of witchcraft was, now looking back at it, I recognize it as of a more traditional, modern traditional witchcraft mixed with traditional Wicca. Mm-hmm. So there was some elements of what we would consider Gardnerian Wicca and such in her practice, and also the more traditional streams of modern witchcraft as well, the folk magic and such. And it was kind of an eye-opener to me to do that, because every book I'd read was very much crystal focused and new agey focused. But then all the practitioners I was meeting that were way older than me obviously hadn't grown up on that, because they with sometimes I would repeat things from these books that I'd read from like the American authors and such. And my kind of witchcraft mentors and teachers would look at me and think and say things like, where have you even got this idea from? I'm really confused. So I think it is definitely a generational thing. The information that we got from books and such in the early 2000s to the late 2000s and then into the 2010s were very much Americanized Wicca-based systems. And then the older generation who didn't grow up on that have very different ideas. So it is, I think, in Britain, it's very different because we had the other traditions of Wicca and such, the Gardnerian, and then the, obviously, Robert Cochrane's influence and such as well. And I think the older generation were more influenced by that, whereas we became a mixture then, those of us who grew up in the 90s and the 2000s, we became this weird fusion of Silver Ravenwolf and Doreen Valiente. And that's it's an interesting mix.
I was going to say, that's quite the mix. That's this pop magic mixed with like deeply ceremonial.
Yeah.
That
is the way I describe it, because the older generation that I would meet that were into witchcraft, the high priestesses of covens that operated in my areas and such, they were very ceremonial, but then they also held a lot of these kind of new age beliefs. And you know, it was very strange to me going to school and talking to people my age who were into witchcraft. And they were very much into fairies and crystals. Mm. And then I'd go talk to my mentors and teachers who were in their 60s, and they're more into things such as ley lines and standing stones and actually going out into nature and doing things in the dirt. Whereas
a nature-based practice that spends time in nature? For shame!
Definitely. And I still remember to this I still remember to this day being shamed by an older witch when I was a teenager, because she was like, how many times have you actually gone out into the woods or to the beach to practice? And I was like, never. At like 14, 15, I was like, never. I usually do it in my bedroom. And she was like, ah, so you're a carpet witch. I was like,
I've never heard that term. I'm stealing that. I'm putting that in my Twitter bio immediately.
Carpet witch. Because another thing that we used to have a lot of discussions about skyclad as well, like going naked during rituals. And I remember this one gentleman who is one of my greatest mentors turned to me and said, I always find it funny when the carpet witches practice skyclad, because they're taking their clothes off to work naked, but they're still wearing a house. So it just doesn't make sense to me. And these things have stuck with me.
It's great. Yeah. Making a note of carpet witch. That's a good one. So,
so for anyone who wants to.
So you're learning, you're sounds like you're very lucky to have found some pretty ethical teachers early on. I guess I'm curious, just real quick, do your Americanized pagan books talk about things like, you know, white sage and you know, some of these other, what did you make of that? Can you even get that there? Like,
So when I was younger, white sage, it was in all the books. It was always like, I remember distinctly reading this one book that talked about the various uses of herbs. And it was very much like, oh, you can use this for cleansing, you can use this for healing, but the most powerful herb is white sage. And I remember being a teenager, new to the craft and all this, and I was there like, I need to get me some white sage because all the witches in my books are doing it. And I couldn't find it anywhere. So I used to go down to Tesco's, the local supermarket, or Asda, which is Walmart over there. And I used to buy kitchen sage, and I didn't realize there was a difference. And I used to use that. And then my mum banned me from using it because she thought it smelled like marijuana. But
well, so does white sage. White sage smells like a lot.
But I've never really used white sage in my practice because I found it very difficult to get it at first, and then by the time it became much more commonly found here, I was already kind of aware of the situation with white sage, and I was already kind of cautious about it. It's quite easy nowadays. I work in a metaphysical shop, so we do unfortunately supply it, but that's not up to me. I just work under a boss.
Sure.
I'm trying to educate people about it right now in my workplace, but it's a difficult conversation.
It's just so interesting. I guess I ask because an unfortunate thing that happens is that so goes America, so goes the world in so many ways. The American music scene, everybody wants to break into the American music scene. Everybody wants, you know, whatever becomes popular here seeps its way elsewhere. And unless we are fresh out of ideas, and then we start going and picking up things like K-pop and Hey, we're boring and not churning out anything original. Let me borrow your thing. But I do find it interesting that an appropriated practice from Native Americans has found its way to the UK.
It's a bit insane, because I remember when I first started attending moots and such and started meeting up with other practicing witches and pagans, there were so many people who were obsessed, like fully obsessed with Native Americans. I remember walking into this one witch's house after a moot once, and she literally had dream catchers on every wall and paintings of Native Americans who were strangely pale and covered in feathers and such. And it's strange, because that obsession kind of seeped into the witching community here. And you can tell that for those who were interested in witchcraft pre the 90s, they have none of that. Like, I never was asked to bring white sage to a ritual and such when I was working with that mentor that I mentioned, my ex-teacher. I was never asked to bring white sage. But then the minute I kind of broke into the actual wider pagan community of younger pagans and such, it's everywhere. And it's really weird to me, like, how much of a grasp it has, even here in the UK, mm-hmm. that we're taking these kind of indigenous traditions and thinking that it's somehow
that aren't
relevant.
Even indigenous to your country. Like, no. That's just what's so interesting to me. They aren't even indigenous to where you live. They are practices that are taken from an oppressed people in a different country. And yeah. just shipped off and exported.
And I mean, even the conversation surrounding Wicca as well, it's really become what I would consider very Americanized. Because we talk about Wicca, and a lot of people talk about this kind of new agey, fluffy kind of, you know, poppy, like you were saying, religion. But here in the UK, it's really strange to talk about it that way, especially when you meet Gardnerian Wiccans, because when you meet Gardnerians who are very, very traditional, or Alexandrians who are very, very traditional, they're nothing like that. They're nothing like that kind of new agey style of Wicca, quote unquote. So it's hard now, because I went through that rebellious emo teenage phase where I was like, Wicca is a load of crap and I don't want anything to do with it. And then I met Wiccans and it was like, that's Wicca? I didn't even realize that was Wicca. That doesn't seem like the new agey stuff. That's confusing.
Yeah, there's
so
your
it's kind of strange.
There's your standard Wicca 101 book, and then there's like talking to Thorn Mooney or
yes.
a Chenek or something. And it's like, oh, there's a whole difference. So let's talk about Wicca, because I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and we used to have a thing called Witchbox, which was sort of a place where you submitted articles, and they pretty much towards the end of its life, they would pretty much publish anything by anybody. So getting an article on there didn't mean as much as I thought it did at the time. I thought I was very impressive getting an article published on Witchbox. I remember I got a lot of feedback from some of my earlier articles and saying, I want to hear you talk about being gay in paganism. And I want to hear you talk about being an LGBT person in paganism, specifically because paganism at one time here in the US felt like it was synonymous with Wicca. And because that is a fertility religion, a religion that all of its Sabbats, it does tend to focus a lot on the gender binary, on the Lord, the Lady, the God, the Goddess, the great whatever, you know, where they in the penis, chalice and blade, and a lot of queer people were having a problem trying to find a space in that culture because of how much it focused on gender and how much it focused on fertility and the actual act of birth. And at the time, what I said was, well, I don't necessarily mind it because, you know, my fertility, I suppose, is my creativity. It's what I put out into the world. It's creating things and things like that. But I'm also somebody that is very firmly cisgender. So I'm curious how somebody who is not interacts with a culture, a religion that you want to be a part of, but that does spend so very much time talking about genitals.
Mm. Well, when I first started kind of practicing, this never even crossed my mind, the idea that there was any kind of pushback on LGBTQ plus people within paganism, because I remember that being a big driving force for me. I remember being a mouthy little 14-year-old and 15-year-old shouting at people like, well, I'm not a Christian because Christianity is horrible to people like me. And whereas my witchcraft and paganism is all so accepting and so loving. And then at around 16, I remember attending my first ever Witch Fest, which is a big, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, the big Witch Fest festival that we have here in the UK. They meet usually at London every year. It's one of the biggest witchcraft and paganism events in the whole of Europe. And it's basically just a day of, well, a day or two sometimes, of talks and workshops, and then a big party at the end of it with a lot of mead and drinking and partying. And usually people like Daughters of Gaia and Damn the Bard play at the end. I remember going to my first one ever of those, and there was a coven there, a Wiccan coven, and they were apparently local to us. That's why they started talking to our little group, because I went with my working group at the time. And they started talking to us and said, oh, we're also from Anglesey. We're also from up that way. And we're a Wiccan coven. And throughout this entire conversation, this high priestess that we'd met didn't look at me. She never looked at me. She never glanced over at me. And right at the end of the conversation, I tried saying something to her because I was like, oh, they're a coven. They're a proper Wiccan coven. Mm. My little 16-year-old self was like, maybe I can be initiated or something. And they're operating in my area. So let's, like, you know, get my name in there. So I started talking to these women, and they just kind of glanced at me quickly. And they gave me this really weird, intense stare. And then they just walked away and they didn't acknowledge that I'd said anything to them. And I thought, oh, that's really strange. And then I tried talking to them again later because they ran a little stall at Witchfest as well. And they, again, completely blanked me or kind of brushed me off and didn't say anything. And later on, when I was talking to one of my friends who knew about this coven, they said, well, it's because, and this was before I came out as trans, this was when I was identifying as a gay male. Mm. They were like, oh, it's because you're a man. They're a Dianic coven and they don't recognize men as witches in their coven. And they don't think you have the balance in you to be able to practice magic. And that was the first kind of occasion I had where I realized that there were still problems, even in the pagan community, towards LGBTQ plus people. It kind of shook me to my core because I was used to getting bullied. I was used to getting hated on for being the way I was, but I wasn't used to getting it from witches. And that really, really hurt me, but I kind of just let it go. And then, but that doesn't even compare to what happened in 2018 when I went to Witchfest again. This was when I was about 21, when I was 21 years old. And I went to Witchfest, and this was my first time going to any kind of big event since coming out as trans. So I was presenting as female for one of the first times ever in public. And it was such an exciting moment for me because I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be seen as myself. I'm going to be seen as my authentic self, finally. And I remember sitting, I had a brilliant day all the way around. And I remember sitting in the kind of catering area later on in the afternoon. And there was another Wiccan coven again. And I'm not sure where this coven was from because they were just these English ladies who had randomly sat near us. And they were talking to one of my friends. And then I came over and started talking to them. And they were asking us, so what do you practice? What do you do? Because obviously Witchfest is, even though it's called Witchfest, there are people from all practices that come to Witchfest. So they were like, are you pagans? Are you druids? Are you witches? Are you heathens? How do you identify yourselves? And when they got to me, I said, I'm a witch. And I referred to myself as, back then, I was like, I'm a Celtic witch. And I said it really proudly. And one of the ladies just looked at me and went, but you're not a witch though, are you? And then I was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, witches are women. And I was like, I am a woman. What are you talking about? And she was like, you're not really a woman, are you? And all this. And they really started digging into me and telling me that being trans meant that I didn't have the balance within me and that I didn't accept myself and that the goddess would never accept anyone like that. I think that's the line that really, really hurt me that day. The fact that they literally said, the goddess wouldn't accept someone like you. And I was just there going, what is happening? And I just kind of, back then, because I was so new to presenting myself authentically, I was so shy and so kind of quiet. And I just sat there nodding, smiling, trying to kind of keep them comfortable, because I was like, I don't want to cause a scene. I don't want to cause a scene. Because even though they were saying these really horrible, hurtful things, they were saying it in a way that almost came out as kind. And British people have this, have a way of doing that. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you're British, you're kind of used to people telling you, oh, you know, you're just a little ugly. And they'll say it in a way that makes you go, is that a compliment? I'm really confused.
Only a little. Just, oh, that's good.
Just a little. You know, and I mean no harm by it. You're just a bit of a cretin. And everything that comes out of English people's mouths sometimes sounds like a compliment, but especially if you've got that southerner posh accent. But I just kind of sat there and I thought, well, I can't make a scene because I have to keep them comfortable. I can't make them feel uncomfortable. And nowadays, I regret it. I wish I would have stood up and screamed at them or something. Or I wish it was socially acceptable to just kind of slap people with gloves, like in the olden days.
We should bring that back. People talk about bringing back capes and cloaks and things. Bring back slapping somebody with a glove.
Yes.
Especially if you're not wearing a mask. You get a glove and then you get a mask.
Yes. Right across the face. And it was just really kind of baffling to me. And that was the night that I decided to go onto the interwebs and do the unthinkable. And I decided to look up transgender and witchcraft on Google. And, you know, I got a lot of really good results from actual transgender practitioners who were talking about how it incorporates into their practice being trans and such. But then I also came across the pages and groups that were slightly unsavory and we're talking about how trans people shouldn't be accepted into witchcraft and paganism because it's unnatural and goes against the natural order of things. And yeah, I went through a bit of a phase then where I struggled with my witchcraft a lot, because a lot of my witchcraft, even as kind of a cis male, when I was presenting as a gay man before I came out as trans, before I fully accepted who I was, a lot of my practice was centered around duality and balance. And I look back in some of my old journals and books of shadows, or what you might call them. And there's a lot of those kind of books where I've filled, where I've said things like true balance comes from duality, comes from the divine feminine and the divine masculine and all this. And you know, it baffles me that even as a gay man, I still kind of stuck to those fertility ideals. And yeah, that was when I kind of went through a crisis and I was like, oh gosh, I don't know if I want to be part of this anymore. If I want to be part of witchcraft, if that's what the focus is. And it very much is kind of the foreground of paganism. Almost every book you get that's like a Wicca 101 or Witchcraft 101 talks about duality and the goddess and God and balance. And it's hard as someone, I assume, for those who identify beyond the binary or outside of it, who identify as non-binary or rather than within a binary system, like I identify as a woman still, so I can still kind of see things within that duality section. I can still see what they're talking about. But for somebody who doesn't even identify within male or female, how do they deal with things such as divine masculinity, divine femininity, and the balance of the two? And what if you've got an energy that's beyond that? And yeah, it was a very kind of thought-provoking moment when I went through that, and it lasted about 3 years, where I was just spiraling down into this hellhole of where do I fit in paganism, because it's such a fertility focused thing. And yeah, I've kind of grown out of that now and realized no, it's not, it's just that the foreground of witchcraft and such is so focused on it. So if you actually dig deeper, there are people who don't talk about that at all. But yeah, it's a strange concept, because I think a lot of people who practice don't ever think about it, especially if you're cis, especially if you aren't LGBTQ at all. I think it's something that can go just unthought about. and it links in with something. Oh, I can't remember who said it now, but a few days ago I saw on Twitter someone had said, you know, we need to think about the why. Why do we believe what we do? Why do we practice what we do? And that was the core of what was going on with me when I went through this spiral of like, where do I fit in paganism? Because I actually started questioning, why do we believe in duality? Why do we believe in this ideal of like divine masculinity, divine femininity, and fertility being the core of our practices? Where does it come from? Because the natural world doesn't fit into our strict binary systems or anything like that. I mean, there are asexual creatures, there are plants that don't operate in the same way as that male-female balance thing. So I think that's something that a lot of witches should consider, is why do we believe these things and how does it actually fit into our beliefs if we genuinely do believe that our beliefs are set by nature? Well, how does it fit into nature?
It's interesting how much, as a queer person, heteronormativity just seeps into us as a default setting, and how we so quickly give up our identity, our way that we see the world, our perspective, our needs, whenever we're presented with, oh, well, this is just the way it is. Oh, it's the god, it's the goddess, it's the chalice, it's the blade, it's the, you know, the penis, the great magical penis in the sky, and the great magical cervix in the earth. And oh, it's just the magic. And I appreciate that there are teachers, creators, authors, educators out there who say, well, let's broaden the scope. Let's bring everyone in. Let's make this work for you. But the problem that I have, and have it more so as I get older and read more and learn more and you know, get more of a perspective on things, is that you're trying to make something that never that was never really intended to fit me, fit me.
Yes.
This was not designed to include me. You are trying to make it include me after the fact. And it's sort of like taking a suit, because I'm a really tall person. It's sort of like taking a suit that isn't quite big enough. It's not long enough for you, and it might be a little too wide, and you take it to a tailor, and a really good tailor can cinch that waist and bring it in and help you with some shoulders and stuff, but can never quite get those sleeves or those pants quite the right length. It's never actually going to fit. And I think that as the pagan community continues to grow, that this is a pain point that we truly need to address. Because so much of our pagan thought and pagan ideals and pagan teachings, whether or not it is Wicca or Wicca light, or Wicca influenced, it is still pretty heavily fertility influenced in some way or another. There's a lot of talk about sex, and when they mean sex with, you know, cis males and cis women. And we still let people like Z Budapest have space in major events. I mean, my gosh, PantheaCon could not seem to stop giving horrible, awful, transphobic people space for many, many, many years. And it's like, please stop doing this. It's a bad thing. You're contributing to harm. And they were like, but attendance and representing all, I guess I want to ask, do you think that there is a place at which our community needs to maybe realize that representing all points of view is harmful?
Oh, definitely. I don't know if you've ever... if you've ever read, I don't know if I should name drop authors that I disagree with here, but
go ahead. I love tea.
I don't know if you've ever read Lisa Lister's book or heard of it, but
I've heard
Lisa
of it.
Lister
I've
wrote
not
a book called Witch, and I picked up Witch from a local bookshop, because I assumed this was during my little spiral. It was during when I was coming out as trans and I was spiraling into where do I fit in the pagan community and all this. I picked up Lisa Lister's book because literally, if you were to look at the cover, it's literally just witch. And then it's like unapologetic, untamed, unashamed. And I thought, oh, this is going to be an empowering kind of 101 book into witchcraft. And
then it spends a lot of time talking about.
It spends a lot of time talking about femininity from the perspective of someone with a uterus.
Yes.
From the perspective of someone who menstruates. Yeah. And it excludes a lot of people. And I remember at the time feeling a bit uncomfortable reading it, but I was like not sure why I was uncomfortable because I wasn't fully aware of the discussion surrounding trans people and such in the craft at that point. And with time, I've come to realize why that book is so exclusionary and such, but it comes up all the time, especially, I don't know if it's the same in the American online groups and such, but in the UK groups, the UK pagan groups and witchcraft groups, that book comes up almost all the time with people asking, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And almost every single time, trans people and gay people and all sorts of people come on and say, well, it's a very exclusionary book and I don't think it should exist and I don't think we should talk about it. And, you know, I think we should critique it for what it is. Mm-hmm. And then people get their comments erased. People get torn down. People get told, well, you're just not listening to other people's points of view. And it almost feels like they're pushing people down and saying, you're not allowed to say this because you should listen to everyone's point of view. But they're not listening to their point of view in the first place.
Yes, but your point of view erases my identity. It erases my existence and it further marginalizes and oppresses me and people that I've cared deeply for. So it's not exactly a two sides of the same coin thing. It's a, you don't think I'm the same kind of person as you with the same right to exist openly and as myself. And those are not the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, it happened very recently. I was literally on one of these groups and a trans man that I'm friends with got blocked from the group for literally just saying that he thought the book was a piece of garbage that shouldn't exist because it's so exclusionary and it excludes so many groups of people. I mean, it's not even just trans people it excludes. It excludes women that don't menstruate. It excludes people. But anyway, it's not just about that book. I mean, in general, I've seen this kind of thing happen a lot. It's almost as though in the name of being open to all viewpoints, they're crushing people that whose viewpoints are being ignored fully. Mm-hmm. We're almost making the space comfortable for people to stand up and say, I don't believe trans people should exist, but then not allowing trans people to stand up and say, well, maybe I should. Maybe I should exist.
Yeah, I circling back on something that you said earlier, you thought, oh, you know, when you were a child, thinking, oh gosh, well, my Christian circle, my Christian influences around me are exclusionary, but my witch community, my pagan community is not. And personally, you know, I think that a lot of people negatively attribute the aspects of paganism that are exclusionary, that are racist, that are transphobic, homophobic, etc., to an influx of ideation stemming from when people were Christian. Because most people come here from being Christian. I mean, the majority of people are Christian. And if they're not, they're in that spiritual but not religious category is number two. And, or at least here in the United States, that's what statistics tell us. And I the sociologist in me just like screams and says, no, it's because we're people. And people are inherently like in-group, out-group, like, no, you're not like me. So therefore you're worse and I'm better. And that has very little to do with Christianity and everything to do with the fact that that's just who we are as people. And when we can get to a point where we can stop trying to blame everything on the evils of Christendom or the evils of, you know, something else and say, no, maybe it is just because I'm a flawed thing and I'm a flawed I'm a flawed meat sack, and maybe I need to go within and stop blaming something else. Maybe then we'll get better.
Yeah, oh, I definitely goodness. Agree with you there, because especially, I don't know if it's a cultural thing, but here in the UK, I kind of find it hard to admit this, but I remember going through that angsty teenager phase where I was like, well, witchcraft is better because people are more inclusive and people are more accepting. And when I look back, I'm like, who from Christianity ever told you that you were wrong? And I'm like, I don't think I remember ever getting told by anyone who was Christian that there was anything wrong with me for being gay or being trans growing up in the UK. You know, I remember watching things from America, like the Westboro Baptist Church and all this, and getting influenced by that a lot. That influenced a lot of my view on Christianity growing up. But from a British point of view or a Welsh point of view, I remember the church being a very accepting and open place. And nowadays, I still do. I go to I live just around the corner from a very big cathedral, and I go there all the time, and they're very accepting. I even walked in there once in a witch's hat, because my my partner's mother wanted to go see the cathedral. And I was like, you had to choose the one day I decided to dress up like Elphaba to go outside to take me into a cathedral. And I remember them
being
accepting.
Please tell me you had the green skin. Did you have the green skin?
Yeah. No. But yeah, I remember they were asking me about like paganism and witchcraft and why I was dressed the way I did and all this. And I remember explaining paganism to them, to the like vicar at the church, at the cathedral and such. And he was so interested and open and accepting and all this. And I don't doubt that there are definitely cruel and vicious people within Christianity in the UK. But I did question as I grew up, like, why did I have this horrible ideology that like, it's me against them, when I'd never experienced any of that. I'd never even gone through that. And like I said, I grew up in a non-religious household. My parents weren't Christian. My family wasn't Christian at all. So I don't know where I got this idea from. I think it was just from watching pagans online rant about Christians, and then also watching things such as the Westboro Baptist Church and the anti-gay kind of things going on over there at the time. And that influenced a lot of what I believed about it. But I definitely agree with you. It's very much a case of, oh, let's blame someone. Let's blame some group. And actually, to say something a bit weird, I think a lot of modern witches are doing the same now with Wicca. They're doing a lot of this kind of like, Wicca is to blame for cultural appropriation in paganism. Yes. Wicca is to blame for anti-trans sentiment. And it's kind of strange how we always seem to find someone to blame.
Yes. Yeah. So there we have now been a pagan community long enough that we can have second and sometimes even third generation pagans. And of course that comes back from when I was new. I'm a witch, I'm not Wiccan. Everybody was very, very quick to, I'm not Wiccan. And I don't know where that came from, except it's just we just so deeply want to feel countercultural. And Wicca is the biggest pagan religion. It's the biggest, it's the most visible, it's had the most books written about it. Willow on Buffy called herself a Wicca. I mean, you know, it's oh my gosh, and so because it's the biggest, I guess we have to blame it and tear it down. And I'm not that. Yes. But your altar is set up with a god side and a goddess side, and you've got a chalice and a blade, and then this and then that, and you celebrate the eight Sabbaths. And you know, I'm not Wiccan, but it'd be real hard for you to tell how I practice. I just don't call myself that. But yeah, I completely agree. And it's rearing its ugly head in the last like 18 months or so with this very strongly anti-Wiccan sentiment coming out online. I don't really know where that's come from. I guess everybody got bored in quarantine and decided to go poke at Wicca for some reason. But perhaps I also think that it's because we have a lack of like 201, 301 Wiccan resources. Everybody has an intro to Wicca book, and then, you know, that's all that seems to be out there. Or there are other books, it's just they aren't being published or promoted as well. But oh gosh, I want to talk about your personal journey, your personal spiritual journey, because it's really resonating with a lot of people, especially right now. I mean, you're kind of going viral. So tell me a little bit about Welsh witchcraft and specifically your passion projects, your area of study and expertise.
Yeah. So like I said, when I first started practicing, it was very much in a neo-pagan method. I was reading the Wicca 101 books, and that was very much my life for a long time, learning about the goddess, the god, and casting a circle and crystals and all these things. And I think everything switched for me when I met Christopher Hughes, the head of the Anglesey Druid Order. He and I met one day. I came home from college. He lived literally just down the street from me. And I remember being really like awestruck by that. I was like, I have the like chief of the Anglesey Druids living on my doorstep. I need to make use of this. I need to like learn from him. I need to go and meet him and see what he's like. And luckily, he's this big, larger than life gay man who's also a drag queen. So he was very kind of warm and welcoming and accepting. And so I instantly clicked with him and thought, well, okay, I've got this friend now who's a pagan, who's a witch, and who's also a druid, because he did identify as all three. He was like, I'm a pagan, I'm a witch, but I'm also a druid. And he kind of taught me about the basics of druidry as opposed to witchcraft, which was my first introduction to something beyond the kind of witchcraft and Wicca. And that eventually segued into talking about the Mabinogi. So the Mabinogi is the Welsh collection of myths and legends that we have that's native to our country. And I grew up with this stuff. I grew up with the myths and legends being taught to me. I remember at school doing plays and such based on these mythologies. So they were very familiar to me, but it never clicked for some reason when I was researching into witchcraft and paganism. It never kind of clicked and came into place that I could use this in my witchcraft and I could utilize this as a foundational kind of grounding point for my paganism. It never clicked into place like that. I was like, no, I have to revere the goddess and God, all this. So he introduced me to all that, and he kind of lifted the veil on that kind of area of life and introduced me to this idea of Welsh Celtic paganism. And that was when I was 16 or so. So that kind of was the seed that began this process. But then I wanted to be a witch. I didn't want to be a druid. I really didn't want to be a druid. I think to my teenage mind, it seemed very cliche, because the druids were very much ceremonial in nature. They dressed in white robes and they met at sacred sites, because growing up on Anglesey, I was surrounded by circles of stone and standing stones and chambered
caves. Oh, how terrible. Ugh.
Yeah. So we would drag ourselves out to these like sacred monuments that are like prehistoric in nature and predate even the druids, the ancient druids. And we would drag ourselves out to these places that looked like smaller versions of Stonehenge, basically, at like sunrise on like a rainy Sunday afternoon, which happened to be the solstice. And we would do like a ritual to the sun while it was pouring it down with rain. And I'd watch the druids and I'd think, they're cool. They're very, very cool. But that's not what I want to be. I don't want to be a druid. So although I kind of was mentored by Chris a lot and he influenced so much of my practice, I always felt like, oh, there's more. There's something more that I need to like dig into, because this just isn't clicking with me yet. And then I came across traditional witchcraft, some people would call it, and kind of got the wrong idea of what that was originally, because you know, a lot of people assume that traditional witchcraft means that you're tapping into really, really old versions of witchcraft and things that predate Wicca. And I think a lot of people move to traditional witchcraft as well as a way of being like, look at me, I'm not a Wiccan, I'm a traditional witch instead. And I'll admit, part of me was that when I first started getting into traditional witchcraft. But it was finding the works of people like Gemma Gowrie, who is from Cornwall. Cornwall is such a similar nation to Wales. It's literally just below us, if you look at the map. It's just below us. Their language, Cerniweg, is literally the closest relation to Welsh. And their folklore is so similar to ours. So reading a lot of Gemma Gary's work, I was like, this sounds familiar. This sounds almost like something that came from where I'm from. And it got me thinking, well, if this exists in Cornwall, surely it exists in Wales. And so that kind of brought me to Welsh folk magic and Welsh healers and charmers and conjurers and all this. And then I started developing my own little brand of Welsh traditional witchcraft, as I call it, because it's harkening back to the magical specialists of Wales' past and the folkloric and folk magical practices of the people of Wales. But even though I use the term traditional, I always tell people it's my own creation. It's new, it's modern, but I'm just influenced and inspired by the past and the practitioners of old. But my path, my practice is only as old as I am. So I kind of love creating that. I love looking back at history and going, well, this is part of my culture and my heritage. And so I'm going to tap into it and I'm going to use it, but I'm not claiming to be some initiate of some deep old pre-witch cult that exists and such. But yeah, it's been really exhilarating delving into my own culture, especially coming from, like I said, in Wales, we have been fed this idea that we're not that big a culture and that we're only just England's neighbor and that's all we are. But learning that we have this richness of mythology, of culture and of magic and such that we can tap into as pagans, it's been really exhilarating. So I just had to share it. And I think that's why it's resonating with so many people, because they're finally acknowledging and learning that we have culture. We have a culture of our own. We don't need to appropriate others.
I think that shocks a lot of people when they start realizing that there's plenty of magic to be made, plenty of culture for you to mine in your own self, in your own family, in your own, native lands. I mean, you know, where you're from and your people have plenty of magic. And I'm so glad to see so many people rediscovering that. What have been some of the biggest misconceptions that people have whenever they find you and find your, you know, what are some things that like, oh, nope, gotta fix that. Gotta help you unscrew that little nugget out of your brain there.
So do you mean like as in to do with the practices that I practice?
Yeah, or? I mean, what are some misconceptions, wrong information? You know, I know that you talk a lot about working with the fae, working with fairies and things, but there's, you know, because it's not as widely written about as some other pagan beliefs, are there any misconceptions, things that people have?
The biggest one I would say is, I think this comes a lot from the Americans that I meet that have Welsh ancestry or Irish ancestry, but they've never been to kind of Britain or Ireland or anywhere like that. A lot of people seem to have this idea of this mythical, singular Celtic culture, and that the word Celtic somehow means one specific culture, and that everything that is Celtic is exactly the same as one another. And they don't realize that it's an umbrella term in the same way that, you know, paganism is an umbrella term, but not every pagan is going to practice or believe things exactly the same. It's the same for Celtic. And Celtic is even more complicated than that, because even historians and anthropologists and people who work within archaeology, they struggle with the term Celtic as well, because it's so complex. And really the only definitive thing we have about what it means to be Celtic within any kind of academic viewpoint is language. That's literally all we can determine as fully Celtic is language. Welsh is a Celtic language, so is Scots Gaelic, so is Irish Gaelic, but Welsh is also completely different to Irish and Scots, even though they're cousins, so there's similarities. but Welsh is a Brythonic Celtic language, so it's kind of different to the Gaelic languages. It's Welsh isn't Gaelic at all, or Gaelic, I think some people pronounce it as. Welsh is not Gaelic at all. We're completely Celtic. But there's a lot of kind of misconception that, oh, if it's true in Ireland, and Ireland is also a Celtic nation, then it must be exactly the same in Wales. And it's just not true. I've had on my TikToks lately. So it's a running gag on my TikTok that people are obsessed with saying that I must be a fairy because I'm weird, I think. But it's this like running gag that I have where I pretend that I'm pretending that I'm mortal. It's hard to explain. Go watch my TikTok.
So I've seen your videos. So you're telling me that you are actually a mortal being?
Of course. I am exactly like everyone else. I am a mortal. I am mortal. I was born like you, 100%.
Okay, well, I descended from a cloud of rainbows and butterflies. So if you were born like me...
No, I am 100% normal. Don't think otherwise.
You do a very convincing mortal accent.
But I kind of, one of the running comments that I get all the time on those videos where I'm like, I am mortal. I am not a fae. Please believe me. A lot of people are like, well, fairies can't lie. Therefore, you're not a fairy. And it's like, I'm an entertainer. I'm doing this for fun. I'm not actually trying to convince you I'm a fairy. But at the same time, that derives more prominently from Irish folklore. And I think people are pushing, and it's the best example of it, they're pushing this idea that like, oh, that comes from Irish folklore. Therefore, Welsh fairy lore must be exactly the same and must follow the exact same rules. And that's one thing like a lot of other influencers and TikTokers and people on various platforms are trying to talk about lately, especially Celtic Shan. She's been talking about it a lot, where she said, like, there's this really horrible ideology of the Celtic nation being a one singular cultural group where everything exactly the same. And for one, it's annoying because it undermines and it's rude to the cultures that exist within the Celtic umbrella term. It's almost like saying they're all exactly the same, therefore we shouldn't look at them as their own individual cultures who have their own individual systems of working. And they do. I mean, Wales has a mythology that is completely separate from Ireland, that is completely different to Irish mythology. There are similarities, there are things that we can see parallels in, but it's completely different. And it's the same with the fairy lore, and it's the same with the language. And yeah, and then you've got the kind of dangerous side of it where... It feeds into the white supremacy of it all and this idea that, oh, Celtic people are one people, and it feeds into this idea of the mythical singular white culture as well, that kind of permeates the white supremacy groups. And yeah, it's a fun misconception, sarcasm implied, I hope.
You know, I appreciate, and I know that you were kind of hesitant earlier to negatively name drop Lisa Lister's book, but I think that there is an urge in our community, and I don't know why, because I've never had that urge, but I host a show called Inciting a Riot, so I don't really care too terribly much about being soft and squishy, I suppose. And I don't find as much value in it as I find in just, you know, open, honest dialogue. But there's this push in our community to like never give a bad review, to never say, oh, this is bad information, or this book is, you know, problematic or harmful in some way. Or incomplete or even dated. I mean, I think that we give such a reverence for people like Scott Cunningham, Silva Ravenwolf, even Dorothy Morrison, who I've had on my show several times. You know, some of those names that have been out since the 80s and 90s and who really kind of created pagan literature as it exists today. But I think that it is important for us to not necessarily beat up on some of those authors or whatever, just because their books are getting old. And I think it's important for us to maybe provide context, say, okay, well, this was good information for 1992. it's been almost 30 years. We need to recognize that, you know, science has progressed a lot in 30 years and technology has progressed a lot in 30 years. Why would you ever think that pagan thought shouldn't have progressed a lot in 30 years? And I think that it's important for us to have those open conversations of, this book is problematic. Here is a better book. Here's a good book for you to read. Do you find, you know, as you're becoming a much more visible person, do you find the urge to maybe stay away from negative reviews, bad reviews, and only ever give positive reviews? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Sometimes, yes. I mean, especially coming from a Welsh background, the whole system of kind of Welsh Celtic myth and such has been kind of either ignored or done wrong in the pagan circles for a long, long time. I mean, there's books such as The 21 Lessons of Merlin.
Remember that book.
Oh my gosh. There's some good stuff in there, but there's also absolute made up crap in there.
Yes. Yes, there is.
When you know the myths of Wales, when you know about Arthurian legend, when you know about kind of Welsh Celtic roots and folklore, it stands out and screams like hell. But I think that's a good example of how things age differently, because now there's a lot of good authors within Welsh Celtic paganism that actually are Welsh and have like studied this stuff. But then it's still happening, like the misconceptions and such about Welsh myth and Welsh lore and Welsh paganism still happens, and I still see it a lot. And I get a lot of people who message me about certain authors that they really, really love and admire. And I do, as my kind of follower count grows and my influence, quote unquote, grows, I kind of struggle with, should I say that I don't like that author? Should I say that I don't like that information? Should I say that I think it's wrong? I mean, I think there's also this idea within modern paganism that if it's published, it's true.
Yes.
And it's hard to get by and past that. But I think being outspoken is kind of something I want to do no matter what. So I will say with all honesty, things like, there's an author called Marie Trevelyan, who is a 19th century folklorist who talked a lot about Welsh witchcraft. And honestly, her books are a load of hogwash. They're completely made up. And she has no sources to back up a lot of her claims. But I think a lot of people go, but it was published in the early 20th century. She's a 19th century, early 20th century folklorist. You know, it was published in 1912. How can it not be real? I mean,
it's logical fallacies, both appeal to history and appeal to appeal to authority. It's as soon as someone is published, all of a sudden they are correct because
it's insane.
Publishers are kingmakers in our community. I mean, I feel like they can do that elsewhere, but no more so than in our community, because as soon as you're published, suddenly you have clout, capital C. Capital C clout. But I think that it is important for you, for folks like you and folks like others, to not necessarily spend the whole time just like trashing a book, but to say, hey, this book is transphobic. If you'd like to learn witchcraft, here, read this other book. Absolutely. But I think that it's important to say this book is transphobic, because one, it helps other people know not to pick that book up or to you know, limit the harm that it can cause. But two, maybe one day it will filter those kinds of messages up through the ranks and get into a publisher's brain that maybe they should stop publishing this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, I have it both ways in this one, because as a trans woman, I kind of want to go onto my profile and onto my kind of platforms and go, hey, this book is transphobic. Stop reading it. Stop buying it. Stop giving that author money. And then I also want to, as a Welsh witch, I also want to go on and be like, hey, this author wrote about Welsh mythology and got it wrong. Stop.
Do it. Because I love both of those. I love both of the this is wrong and here's why. It's not just, yeah. Oh, this is wrong and this is bad because they don't know, you know, a past participle from gerund or whatever. But it's important that other people know that this is not good discourse. And then you turn around and say, but this is good discourse. This is what good discourse looks like. Let's model good behavior. But let's recognize and call out bad behavior when it happens. Because I think both of those are equally important. And I think if you only focus on one, you allow the bad to flourish.
Yeah. And I think there's room as well for a conversation about, there's this idea that if you leave a bad review about something, or if you critique anything in a book, then you must hate that author. You must think that their work is trash. And it's like, no, I might shoot myself in the foot now and I might make myself hated by this author, but Laura Tempest Zakroff, the author of Weave the Liminal, I adore that book. I adore Laura Tempest Zakroff. She doesn't know me at all, but I love her. I love her work. Absolutely adore everything she puts out. I loved The Witch's Cauldron. I loved Weave the Liminal. I loved Sigil Witchery. I loved all the work she puts out. I love following her on Twitter. But I remember at a meeting, moot that I attended once, I critiqued the fact that she mentions the Cauldron of Anwen in her book. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that sounds vaguely Welsh. That must be something to do with Welsh paganism, Welsh Celtic myth and such. So I kind of did some digging to try and see, like, maybe there's a Cauldron of Anwen that I don't know about, that I just am ignorant to, even though I've grown up on these myths and such. And I spoke to a load of other Celtic pagans, a load of other Welsh folk that I know that who have also read that book. And everyone was like, no, I think she means the Cauldron of Anwen or the Cauldron of Anwen, but she's just done it wrong. And instantly when I said, like, oh yeah, she got that wrong, someone in my moot went, oh, so you don't like the book then and you don't think I should read it? And I was like, no, just because she got that one thing wrong doesn't mean it's a bad book. It just means that we should acknowledge this is incorrect slightly. It's just a misspelling of the word. It's just a kind of understanding of the word Anwen or Anwen. Literally nothing horrible. And I think that's something that a lot of pagans need to realize, is just because you have a criticism doesn't mean you're hating, doesn't mean you're trashing them, and doesn't mean that you want to cancel them. It just means, oh yeah, I have this little critique, but that's it. Apart from that, amazing book. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've got a book coming out later this year and I'm kind of going through this now. I know there's plenty in it. My friends and I have a little bet going as to which chapter is going to get me canceled first. But so my friends are like, you should just name it Hot Takes, the book. but I think that critique is incredibly important. It's incredibly valuable. The singer Lana Del Rey put out an album, something like Norman Effing Rockwell or something like that, a couple of years ago. I can't believe that 2019 is now a couple of years ago. And she got into the NPR music critic Ann Powers is someone who is beloved and highly respected in her field. And she gave a critique of Lana Del Rey's album, and it was a brilliant and glowing review. I mean, utterly glowing. I would love for somebody with Ann Powers' mastery and experience and wealth of knowledge, would love for someone like that to spend that much time on a critique of my book. Or anything that I put out ever. I would, drag me, sis, drag me. That's fine. Yes, please, God, I live for it. But I mean, she goes song by song. Powers spends time sort of meditating on where Lana Del Rey, herself fits into the overall American songbook, where this album fits. And sure, there are parts of it that are critical, because that's what a critique is. You can't walk away from the review thinking that the album is anything other than brilliant. But to give a fair critique of something, even something that you find to be brilliant, you have to say, well, but these parts are odd or a little derivative, or they, you know, especially if it's in a book of nonfiction, it's, well, these details aren't exactly correct, because I think it's important for somebody to read something contextually. Mm-hmm. Oh, chapter 3 is a little messy and there's not quite enough support there, but the book overall, the message of the book overall is this. And I think that that's important, that's valuable, and you should read it. You know, oh gosh, track 7 is a little messy, but the album overall is good. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And I think you should listen to it. I don't understand why more reviews aren't like that. I think that that's incredibly important. And I remember Lana Del Rey went onto Twitter and just put Ann Powers on blast. And like, the music community came out and was like, I don't think you realize what a gift Ann Powers gave you by, one, even deigning to write an article about you. But two, did you read the whole review? Because he loved your album, loved it. And the language that she used was just ebullient. And if you can't take just a hair of critique, I'm concerned about you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we wrap up here, I do want to ask one last time, are you a fairy?
No.
Okay. Well, I am convinced.
I am completely 100% mortal. Just like you. Just like you. Just like you. Like everyone else in this world, 100% mortal, born from a
woman,
a thing that babies woman. Come yep. out of.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I did mortal things like grow up and
work in a subway. Food. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I did that.
Mara Starling, it has been one of the greatest pleasures of 2021 so far, getting to speak to you. So thank you so much for giving me the gift of your time and your experience and your humor. If folks want to find you, where can they seek you out?
Oh, they can find me at Mara _ Starling pretty much everywhere. It's TikTok, Instagram. I am on Facebook, but I don't do much on there. And anyone who is in actually the UK, who's in the UK, who might be listening to this, if you are local to Chester, Chester in Cheshire, just over the border from Wales, I also work in a metaphysical shop where I do offer readings and such there, and also run classes and workshops and moots and all sorts, usually when the world isn't ending. So if you're local to there, seek me out. That's fine. Don't.
Are we going to name drop the shop?
It's Susie K at the Secret Garden on Bridge Street.
Oh, that sounds charming.
It's a beautiful shop. We call it a little fairy shop. It has a secret garden in the back. It has a 17th century Carolean ceiling.
Is that where you do all those fantastic videos where you pop out from behind things?
Oh, no. That's just my city. Chester, that I live in.
That's just where I live. I'm definitely, I'm definitely a mortal person that's not from fairyland.
The city is a Roman settlement, an old Roman settlement, and there's also Viking influence here. So we've got like a shrine to the goddess Minerva.
Got
pillars from old Roman baths. We've got city walls that look like castles and all sorts. It's the perfect place to shoot a fairyland style video.
It's lovely. Well, thank you, Miss Mara Starling. I appreciate your time. You have a good day.
You too. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today. Episode 161, Inciting a Welsh Witch Riot. I want to thank my guest again, Miss Mara Starling. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for keeping us on our toes and for presenting such a unique version of witchcraft and reviving these Welsh practices for a whole new generation. More about Mara and how you can get in touch with her and her various social accounts is going to be on the website at incitingariot.com. Other ways that you can reach me, I'm pretty much at Inciting a Riot on whatever form of social media you're using, except Snapchat. I'm not on there, and I don't think it's not a thing I need to be on. So yeah, so you get me on the TikTok and the Facebook and the Instagram and Twitter, and that is more than enough. That is just more than enough. But yeah, you can find me at Inciting a Riot on most social medias. I'm also Firelight on Facebook, but I took it off my phone last year because, boy howdy, mental health. And let me tell you, I do sleep a whole lot better and spend a whole lot less time on my phone taking Facebook off. If you would like to join my Patreon, patreon.com/incitingprojects, that will not only give you access to early episodes of the show, both audio and visual, but there is going to be a tier at the end of this month for those old podcast episodes. So that'll go up at the end of January as I start archiving shows from the public feed. Like I said at the beginning of the show, this is really just because the kind of show that I've done has really focused on current events and conversations currently happening. And, you know, as I've talked to some of you listeners and stuff, some of that's just really dated right now. And going back and listening to old episodes, it's just nobody really cares about the news headlines from from March of 2010 or something like that. So we're going to start archiving some of those things, definitely from before 10 years ago, and then maybe up to 2016. And then just as the years go on, we'll continue to archive things and make those available for Patreon supporters. And that'll give you guys something extra to as a treat. And then I am thinking a plan in the future might be to revisit old podcast topics and sort of talk about how discourse has changed, how my views have changed, perhaps how research has changed, and our collective understanding as a community has changed regarding some of those old hot button issues. But anyways, I'm going to leave you, as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.